happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, we're going to be talking about the Democratic Party saber-waving against Putin and Russia at the Democratic Convention and how Putin became so hated. Also, we're going to look at what my guest, Ray McGovern, residing down in North Virginia, has to say about the next type of warfare. Will it be nuclear? Will it be traditional? Or will it be cyber warfare? That looks like it's highly probable based upon what the Mossad and the National Security Agency did together in creating malware in Iran. The trouble is it backfired. Once they found out, and it wasn't the Iranians who discovered this, that they had this ingenious bug in their system that could disguise itself in such a way that it never had to report back, and meaning it was one way in, and therefore couldn't be detected. The American scientists actually discovered this, and the only people they knew had the ability to do this were the Americans and the Israelis. What they didn't know is that the Israelis were working against the National Security Agency's interest in the Defense Department and the American people, because they kept a separate bug that no one knew about that would completely disable every single computer and electrical device, satellites, everything in Iran. Now, why would you do that unless you had some intention of attacking Iran so they couldn't communicate with each other in Iran? It's a big country, three times the size of Iraq, 83 million people. And don't think for a second that all Iranians are radical Muslims. They are not. They have a very educated society. Many of those people, at least half, are young people who are opposed to the way the theocracy has worked. Why in the world would you want to attack them? What would be the consequences? We're going to ask him. And also, what has happened in Turkey? What has happened with NATO? NATO was supposed to have been disbanded a long time ago. Now it's doing military exercises bordering Russia. Why? Is Russia invading other countries right now? Is Russia a threat to the world? No. Look at their military budget for decades. Look at our military budget. Look at who's been invading countries and regime change. Why aren't the American media's asking those tough questions? Why did you think that you had the right to destroy Libya? I didn't hear Hillary Clinton asked that once. So let's see what Ray McGovern has to say on these issues. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst for 27 years under seven presidential administrations, from John F. Kennedy to George H.W. Bush. Among his duties was preparing the presidential daily brief, which was a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam and served as the Assistant National Intelligence Officer for Western Europe. But since retiring, Ray has been a vocal peace activist and a journalist, and he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was falsified to justify war and regime change. And he also works with Tell the World an ecumenical Catholic publishing house, and he is the author of several important articles and books. He holds theology degrees and philosophy degrees from Fordham University, a background in Russian history, and is a graduate of Harvard Business School, and also has a certificate from Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Gary, I can hardly hear you. Is there any way that you can turn the volume up?
Sure. I'll ask Jesse to get it as loud as it can go. All right. Now, Ray, would you please discuss the following areas that you're concerned about? We know what Obama has done versus what he promised to do when it comes to Russia and peace activities and taking away nuclear weapons and not invading countries and being for human rights. That's what he promised. Then we saw what he did. And he has called Vladimir Putin a tyrant, a dictator, and an evil. And now Hillary Clinton, who will likely be the next president, is saying the same thing, that he is a Hitler, and she has no problems nuking Iran. She has no problems fighting Russia and China, and supporting even more military adventurism around the world. So take us through what you see the dangers of a continuation of Obama's policies with even someone who is more hyper-militarist in Hillary Clinton, in Russia, in Syria, in supporting NATO. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. There are dangers all around. Let's start with Europe. It used to be that the Soviet Union would be the bugaboo that could enhance our defense expenditures. And then disappeared as an enemy. And now they have reappeared as if they were Lazarus from the tomb. We have charges against Russian aggression and Russian preparedness for war, which are purely invented, synthetic, and designed to, well, in the final analysis, you pointed out before, cui bono, who profits from all this? Well, it is indeed the arms manufacturers, the arms traders, the people whom a good Pope Francis, of all people, told Congress was unacceptable because they were blood-soaked arms traders. And they all clapped and they laughed. And, of course, they're getting a cut of those arms deals in the back of their pocket. They're getting reelected and they're appropriating more money for arms manufacturing. I mean, is this a great country or what? So that's at the bottom of all this. And now we have generals who are speaking out. You know, I didn't watch much of the conventions. I just couldn't stomach them. But I went back and I watched the speech of General John Allen, a Marine Corps retired. It's scary. It really is scary. He is sort of unleashed. He's very much endorsing Hillary as someone who will be needed to enforce U.S. exceptionalism, the fact that we are the sole superpower in the world and the sole, what's the word they use, the sole indispensable country in the world. Now, when I go around to colleges and I talk to young people, I test them on their grammar, Gary, and I say, now, you all know about synonyms. They know that. How about antonyms? Well, usually only one or two know about an antonym. So I said, what's the antonym for indispensable? And, they kind of scratch their heads. Well, could it be, dispensable? Well, that's what it is. So if you're going to repeat, as Obama and General Allen and everybody else, Hillary included, do, that we are the sole indispensable country of the world, you are by definition saying that all other countries are dispensable. That doesn't go over really well. And, you know, in the final analysis, Gary, it can be looked on as the last gasp of empire. Our empire is being frittered away. China, just today, the Chinese defense minister rattled some sabers with respect to a possible war in the South China Sea. Now, what are we doing in the South China Sea? Well, you know, if you can't prove that Russia is so much a military threat in a strategic way anymore, well, you pivot to China. Well, thank God for China. Thank God for the pivot, because now we can build still more aircraft carriers, still more streamlined jets and so forth, and because of the threat from China. Well, we can make these countries into threats, and that's what we're doing. So we have the Far East. We have Turkey falling apart as the eastern anchor of NATO. We have the German foreign minister criticizing the 31,000 troop exercise on Poland's border with Russia, the largest concentration of troops on Russia's border in that part since 75 years ago, Gary, when the Nazis invaded Russia during World War II. So if I were a Russian, if I were Putin, I would be thinking, what's going on here? These people seem to be kind of unleashed. They are making the Russians, my people, out to be a strategic threat, when indeed they have no evidence to adduce to justify that. Now, with respect to NATO, 2 years ago, there's a U.S. Air Force general, head of NATO forces. His name was Breedlove, but he acted very much like Strangelove. He made up a bunch of stuff, okay? He made up a Soviet invasion, he made up a Russian invasion of Ukraine. He made all this kind of stuff up, and he did that despite the fact there was no intelligence. The German service ridiculed him. There's no Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine, and they didn't invade Crimea either. They already had 25,000 troops in Crimea under a mutual agreement with the Ukrainian government to protect their naval port there. So what I'm saying here is that Breedlove made up this stuff, and we helped to debunk it. We had a right to Chancellor Merkel to say, look, don't believe the commander of NATO. He's using spurious intelligence just the way they did before the attack on Iraq. We had to write to her that, okay? Now, this time, they're not even making up the stuff. They're just saying 60 times a day on the boob tube, Russia's a big threat, Russia's a terrible threat, and now what is Russia doing? Well, as you know, let me just back up a second and talk about the release of those emails. Now, we're talking documentary evidence, right? And those emails showed that Hillary Clinton stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders. There's no two ways about it. She and the DNC did that. That's what those emails show. Now, what was the reaction? It was right before the convention. And they turned the propaganda organs on to say it's Putin's fault. Well, that's quite a stretch, isn't it? Well, let me go through what they're saying. Putin, you see, wants Hillary to lose, and so he got this information illicitly, of course, and gave it to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks in hopes that it would damage her prospects for beating Trump. Now, as I've tried to point out, there's a major premise there that Vladimir Putin would prefer Trump to be his opposite number in a strategic sense. In other words, to have Trump's finger on the nuclear button. You know, I know a little bit about Russian leaders. I've been watching them for over half a century now, most of it from a professional point of view. And my notion is that the last thing that Putin would want is a reckless person who takes great umbrage at the slightest slights, real or imagined, and who brags, literally brags about being unpredictable. Now, put yourself in Vladimir Putin's place there. Is that the kind of guy you would work, however surreptitiously or overtly, to make his opposite number as the U.S. leader? I don't think so. And so the whole notion that that Trump and Putin have this love affair going, and that Putin was responsible for releasing these emails, that was all a classic diversion mechanism to divert attention from what the emails said. And if you look at Chuck Todd, for example, I call him Chuck Toad now because he's such a toady. He had Julian Assange on his program, and he asked him all about, you know, why did you do this? Who did this? How did this Russians give that? He never even addressed what the emails said. And as I said before, the emails make it very clear that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I mean, she would, well, actually, one of her emails was to Chuck Todd, MSNBC. And she said, hey, you got to call these people. This has got to stop. What had to stop? Well, Joe Scarborough and Mika, they were saying that these emails were terribly damaging to Hillary. Now, what did Todd do? Well, he said, oh, yeah, okay, you can reach me between these hours and we'll talk about this. And guess what? Joe and Mika stopped. So it's the most transparent thing. So it worked like a charm. They got all the propaganda media to focus on Putin being responsible somehow for releasing these emails in order to get Trump elected over Hillary. I mean, it was so, well, I just have to say that the media are so irresponsible these days that, you know, having spent 53 years in this town of Washington, I've never seen the likes of it. Thank God for the alternative media, for programs like yours, Gary, where people, if they have sense enough, can tune in and find out what's really going on.
I appreciate that answer, Ray. It was very definitive. Would you now take a look at what we're doing in Syria, what Russia is doing? Russia seems to be liberating Syria more than the United States. And is it not true that for 14 months on our effort to deal with the terrorists and ISIS and ISIL and al-Nusra in Syria, we never once bombed those 12,000 oil convoys going from our friend Erdogan in Turkey into Syria, stealing Syrian oil, bringing it back into Turkey, selling it for about $20 a barrel on the black market, going into Iraq, stealing Iraq oil, bringing it back into Syria, all of which the United States intelligence agencies knew, the White House knew. Also, the corruption of this family. Now, lo and behold, they failed in a coup, and now the president of Turkey is taking it out on anyone he thinks could be, was a part, but anyone he didn't like. It's a big purge going on, and he now believes that the United States was behind this coup. So that's going to make a whole game changer, because Turkey now looks like they're going to go in and have negotiations with Assad in Syria and negotiate with Putin in Russia. So talk about that. Then the fact, I decided to look into the history of Libya. And to do this took about 3 weeks. I looked at every single honest, objective source, nothing from Libya itself. And here's what I found. I found that they had the most democratic government probably in the world, that they had thousands of these councils that any Libyan could vote on any legislation, and it superseded what Gaddafi wanted. And it showed examples of how Gaddafi wanted to end the death penalty, but they didn't. How he wanted to do other things, they didn't want to do. They prevailed. How they had the highest standard of living in all of Africa, 54 countries in Africa, how women had more rights and better educated than any nation in the Middle East, including Israel, including Africa, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, Jordan. The number one, They had the lowest infant mortality, the longest age expectancy, the free health care, free education care, not just in Libya, anywhere in the world. They had the greatest public works project in the history of Africa with this giant reservoir that was feeding the aqua that was feeding over 100 million African farms and agricultural projects water that every time they sold oil, it went into central banks. It then went by proportion into Iraqi families. You got $50,000 when you got married. You got a house for free. You got a farm for free. You got your tractor for free. You got seeds for free. You got, there was no homelessness in there. I also found out that Gaddafi said he will not get a home for his mother and father until every person in Libya had their own home. And as a result, when his father died, his father was still living in a tent, didn't have a home. And so it is not that I like Gaddafi. I don't. But what we were told, that he represented a clear and present threat, that he was killing his own citizens, none of that was true. And independent media and investigations showed that was true. And yet the American media, including the New York Times, refuses to correct the record on that. And 22,000 Libyan civilians were killed. The country is now a hotbed of terrorist activity. We're once again bombing in there. We have troops on the ground. And now I find out from information that journalists have uncovered, credible journalists, that France had wanted special oil concessions. All these countries lined up, including Great Britain, who want, and Italy, that had once invaded. I got all the list of all the countries that invaded Libya, including Italy and France. And none of this story was told. All we said, all we heard was the cackle of Hillary Clinton say, "We came, we conquered, he died." And then we found a picture of how he had been sodomized with a knife, how he had died. And now look at all the gold was confiscated. And we have a failed state. I'd like for you to address that and other countries that have been impacted by us, including how we support Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia then is attacking the poorest country in the Middle East, the one least able to defend itself, and causing massive harm to its people. And also talk about how we end up putting ourselves at the center of all this, denying everything. Could you take us in that direction, please?
Yeah. Well, Gary, I'll just say as a preface here that there is one change that I've observed in the last half century here, and that is that we no longer have in any real sense a free media in the Fourth Estate. That's very bad news, and that change dwarfs all the others I've observed of the last 50 years. That said, we do have the Fifth Estate, we have the Internet, we have the web, we have programs like yours. And so these questions are all very relevant, but they will not be found on the pages of the paper of record, the New York Times or the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. Okay, here's a case in point. I was reading in the Times on Monday that the spokesman, the Pentagon spokesman, had just announced that we started another war. Now, this wasn't the president. This was not the Congress. This was the Pentagon spokesman saying, oh yeah, over the weekend we started bombing Libya with our Air Force. Whoa, not so much as a statement out of the White House. And of course, Congress has completely given up its role, its constitutional role on approving war. So not a peep out of Congress. We are, for the first time, overtly striking Sirte, the place where ISIS is supposed to be having a stronghold in Libya. And it started over the weekend. And how we knew about it? Well, the Pentagon spokesman said, oh, and by the way, we're bombing Libya now. So that's what's happened to our, you know, division of government here, the equal powers of Congress, the executive, and the judiciary. It's all in the executive right now. And what we hear about these things, we hear about it from the Pentagon spokesman. Now, the email the emails that have been released now, but not really gone through with any care, show that it was all a crock, as we would say in the Bronx. There was no real threat that Gaddafi was going to decimate those people in the eastern part of Libya. That was used as an excuse to start a no-fly zone, which was advertised as grounding Gaddafi's aircraft. Now, Hillary Clinton single-handedly persuaded the Russians and the Chinese at the UN not to veto that. She promised all manner of things, that this was just to make sure that Gaddafi didn't kill all those people that Hillary said he was threatening in the eastern part of Libya. What was going on there was the beginning of a kind of a Libyan spring, and it was not at all clear who was in charge, but there were, of course, already terrorists involved, but there was no indication that Libya in the person of Gaddafi was going to decimate them. Now, what happened? Well, there were all kinds of backdoor negotiations going on. One of our top generals in Europe was talking to Gaddafi's son on the side, and so was Denis Kucinich. And we were reassured by responsible people that Gaddafi didn't have the slightest intention of doing what Hillary was accusing him of. And yet, we not only imposed this no-fly zone, but we gave the French, the Italians, and the British all these sophisticated missiles to do a lot more than just prevent Libyan planes from flying. Now, the question is, why? Why would we do all this? Well, Libya has oil that is the purest oil you can imagine. You hardly need to refine it. And long story short, France, Italy, the Brits to an extent, covet that oil, and they wanted to get more of a share of it. Now, that's very often at the bottom of all this, and they persuaded Hillary that, hey, yeah, we do this no-fly zone, we get rid of Gaddafi. And it was French Special Forces folks that cornered him in his hometown and brutalized him, as you said, sodomized him with a knife or a bayonet. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton cackled about how we came, we saw, and he died. So all this kind of stuff goes back to economic realities and the notion that we are indispensable as a country, and by extension, our allies, the French, the Italians in this case, are also indispensable. And so if they need really pure oil, well, there are ways we can get that. And the way we got it this time is to put up a threat from Gaddafi, similar to the one we did from about Saddam Hussein. Make believe he's the devil incarnate and make sure that you hoodwink, which is what they did, the Russians and the Chinese, into abstaining and not vetoing the UN resolution. And you go ahead and you decimate Libya. There are three governments there now. The Pentagon spokesman yesterday was, or 2 days ago, was asked, well, which government invited you in? And he said, the one that the UN set up. Well, of course, that's the one that we set up. So it's totally cynical to think that we were in there for good purposes. We were in there for what I just described. And as you pointed out, Libya was the most literate, the most liberal in many ways, the most advanced civilization in Africa, and now, of course, it's a shambles. One thing that is relevant here is that when Hillary Clinton, and we can't absolve Obama from this, decided to make war on Libya under whatever pretext, they never even compared notes with Congress. They didn't even discuss it with Congress. And I remember watching a Senate hearing where Senator Sessions from the South there, he was up in arms because he read somewhere in the Constitution that only the Congress could authorize a new war. And so he had Secretary of Defense Panetta testifying, and he said, "Now, Secretary Panetta, what do you think is necessary to start a new war?" And Panetta said, "Well, you need a coalition of the winning, of the willing. You probably should get some NATO approval or something." And Sessions is looking at him with his mouth agape. And finally he says, "Mr. Panetta, are you not aware that Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution reserves the right to declare war?" And what Panetta did was just look right back at him. He said, "Senator, President Obama is going to do everything necessary to defend this country. That's just the way it is." And Sessions, you know, closed his mouth and said, whoa. So the question there was, Sessions was worried that we were going to attack Syria without so much as a how do you do to Congress. And we almost did. We almost did in the fall of 2013 when Obama was mousetracked by his own people, starting with Hillary Clinton, into drawing a, quote, red line against the not only the use but the movement of Syrian chemical weapons. And they almost got Obama to start yet another new war with no reference to Congress. And he stopped at the last minute. And you know what? One of the things that Obama is the proudest of, and he told this to Jeffrey Goldberg, that all my advisors told me that once I set that red line, I had to attack Syria. We had to do shock and awe in Syria. And he said, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that I resisted the efforts of everyone, from Biden to Hillary to everybody, to do that, Kerry and so forth. And it wasn't necessary. Why? Well, number one, he realized it was a false flag sort of thing. He realized that he had been mousetrapped into setting a red line against chemical use in Syria. And then what happened was the rebels, now these were probably the good rebels, the quote moderate rebels that we support, they took the precursors for these sarin gases that they got from the precursors from Europe. They put them together. It was homemade sarin. And General Dempsey was able to tell the president just before he pressed the button for all the missiles to go from our fleet in the Mediterranean. General Dempsey said, "Mr. President, my British colleagues have samples of that sarin. It's homemade sarin. It's not the sarin that we know to be in Syrian government stocks." Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because Obama finally put his foot down and said, whoops, we're not going to do a war this time. And Hillary Clinton and everybody else who could be called a neocon was in high dudgeon. They were cheated out of their war in Syria. And, so it still goes on, this surreptitious war under the horizon. But a last word, you had asked about, you know, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Israel, what their interests are here. Well, let's take Israel first. When Obama was just about to press that button on war in Syria, and there was some consternation, not only did General Dempsey warn him about the false flag, you know, about being mousetrapped, but the British Parliament, for the first time in 3,000 years, I think, voted against the war, okay? The American public didn't want another war. And it was August, late August, and congressmen and representatives and senators were home. And so they were treated to a no more war chant that they couldn't resist. There were other factors in play, but who saved the day? A fellow by the name of Vladimir Putin. Now, how did that happen? Well, Putin and Obama discussed this matter of Syrian chemical weapons when they got together in Belfast, or in Northern Ireland anyway, in June of 2013. They set up a working group They said, look, you know, maybe we can get rid of these things and we can get this danger removed, at least in Syria. And so they set this up. Now, when Obama almost was mousetrapped into launching war in Syria, he ended up going to St. Petersburg for a summit. And that was on the 4th of September 2013. Putin met him and said, look, Mr. Obama, we talked about getting rid of Syrian chemical weapons. I think I can persuade Bashar al-Assad to do precisely that. And Obama said, you can. And Putin, you know, give me a day and we'll see if this can happen. And meanwhile, we have that working group working on this, so we should be able to do this pretty quickly. The next day, Putin tells Obama, okay, we got it wired. Tomorrow, the Syrian foreign minister is going to get up, and he's going to say, we have agreed to have our chemical weapons destroyed on a U.S. naval ship expressly outfitted for that purpose. Wow. Now, what did that do? That pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire. That was a peaceful solution. How did the neoconservatives, how did the people who wanted war with Syria react? They were so angry. I experienced some of that personally. It was just so bad here in Washington, they didn't get their war. Now, let's do these foreign countries. Why would anybody want this kind of strife in Syria? Well, there was a new New York Times correspondent, actually she was the bureau chief, Jody Ruderin. She had been there a couple of months by the summer of 2013, and to her credit, she went to the Israeli officials she had been introduced to and some former officials and asked them, you know, how do you look at Syria? What is your preferred outcome of this strife? And she was told, among others, by Alan Pincus, who had been the consul general here in New York, she was told, well, look, Jody, this doesn't sound very humanitarian, but you know, our preferred outcome is no outcome. And she said, hello? Could you explain that? He says, well, look, again, this is a little awkward, but it's sort of like a playoff game. Well, you don't want either side to win, and you don't want either side to lose either. As long as Sunni and Shia are killing each other off in Syria, and not only in Syria, but in the rest of this area, quote, Israel has nothing to fear from Syria, end quote. Now, how do I know that? Well, I know that. I know that because it was in the New York Times, and I suspect it was because the censors in the New York Times were all off at Jones Beach having a swim because it was the Labor Day weekend. But it got into the New York Times. It's sitting out there, and it's the best explanation of how Israel sees its interests in prolongation of this strife in Syria. Among other reasons, of course, is that as long as you have bedlam in Syria, it's very hard to reinforce or resupply Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now, am I saying that this matters? It matters greatly. Because if you look for a reason why the United States would be doing the things it's been doing for the last 5 years with respect to Syria, if you look at why all of a sudden the president and Hillary Clinton decided that Bashar al-Assad has to go, he's got to go. Well, why? Is Syria a danger to the United States? No. Well, you have to go. All I'm saying here is that there is no daylight between U.S. policy and the policy of Israel with respect to Bashar al-Assad, with respect to Syria, ever since they started this business under Hillary Clinton in 2011. That's the explanation for how we are so influenced by Israeli policy. Now, how about the Saudis? Well, you know, I can't tell you that I understand the Saudis very well, but apparently Sunni and Shia really hate each other, right? Okay. And they're willing to do extraordinary things. And so you have the Saudis actually stoking not only the, quote, moderate rebels, but ISIS. Now, why would they do that? Well, again, I can't tell you why, but they do it. Now, how do they get away with it? I can tell you how they get away with it, Gary. During the Obama administration, we're talking 7.5 years now, I don't think Americans realize how much money, how much money the arms that we have offered to Saudi Arabia, how much they were worth. Would you believe $100 billion, B as in boy, $1 billion? Now it's just 7.5 years, offered to Saudi Arabia arms produced here worth $100 billion for cold cash on the barrel, so to speak. Okay? Now people say, Ray, for Pete's sake, don't exaggerate. Now, only $50 billion has been approved. Gary, where the only is an adverb or an adjective there, I don't know, but I know it doesn't belong before the figure $50 billion. That's the long and short of it with respect to the Saudis, the Qataris, and others. Turkey, a little bit different. Turkey wanted to assert itself in northern Syria, make sure that the Kurds don't have any beachhead there, and they just wanted to have the overweening influence on whatever happens in Syria. So those three allies, so to speak, are the flies in the ointment. They're great big mosquitoes, almost like Zika because they're poisonous. And what's happening? Well, just look, millions and millions of people, and I do not exaggerate, millions and millions of people in that whole area, refugees, homeless, deprived of the bare necessities of life, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. Now, there was one change, and in this change, President Obama showed himself to be sensible. Late last year, Obama and Putin met at the UN, the end of September, and Putin said to Obama, Look, nothing's getting better in Syria. We have a special interest in stopping terrorists there because a lot of them are coming from Chechnya and other parts of Russia. They're getting excellent training in terrorism, and they're coming back. Now, you guys, you have an ocean between terrorists and you, but we don't. And so we're going to put a stop to this. You have watched us during the month of September, we're talking 2015 now. You have watched us put all manner of new military equipment in Syria. Be advised that we're going to use it starting tomorrow. Now, we just hope that you will see this for what it is, an effort to tamp things down here, an effort to defeat ISIS first and foremost. We don't care about Assad just now. We want ISIS to be confronted. That's what we're going to do, and we ask you to help us. Now, to his credit, Obama said, okay, I will have John Kerry get in touch with Sergei Lavrov. They're going to work out arrangements so our aircraft don't bump into each other or shoot each other down, and we'll work on this. And in record time, during the fall of last year and the beginning of this, there have been negotiations like there always should have been around a big table with all the stakeholders. Assad, the bugaboo about Assad has to go before any negotiations was dropped sensibly by Kerry and Obama. The bugaboo against having Iran participate in any of these negotiations also dropped. So what Obama and Kerry have shown themselves able to do is rise to the occasion occasionally, okay? And there are two instances I would cite, the one I just recited, and then, of course, the sensible resolution of the Iranian nuclear program, a nuclear program that people suspected was aimed at weapons, but which the intelligence community decided had not been orchestrated toward weaponry since the end of 2003. So those two things, Obama showed a little bit of courage. I think it was Western Europe and the other people who helped him negotiate the Tehran thing that made the difference. On Syria, I think it was General Dempsey. And actually my friends in the intelligence community, because I really should have mentioned that, they were unwilling to support John Kerry when he got up just 10 days after the sarin attack outside Damascus on the 21st of August, 2013. Kerry got up at the State Department and said, "We know this was Bashar al-Assad. Bashar al-Assad did this. He said he did it. His governor went blah, blah, blah." Okay? Now, I counted how many times. There were 35 times when John Kerry claimed that those chemical attacks, which, of course, was the red line violation, those chemical attacks were done by Bashar al-Assad's forces. Now, you don't have to be a Shakespearean scholar, Gary, to remember, you know, "Methinks he doth protest too much." Well, it was amazing. Now, what happened? Well, after that, the press here said, "Well, how do you know that, John?" You know, they ask very humbly always, and John Kerry says, "Well, we just know it because, you know, social media are really great. They're a wonderful source, and we know it." All the information that they adduced besides social media turned out to fall flat on its face. The information that they tried to show proved that the government did it. Now, I mentioned my former colleagues. When the balloon goes up, when there's a crisis of these proportions, in my experience, and that goes back 50 years, there's always been a need for a, quote, intelligence assessment, end quote. This is something that would be trotted out at the UN, the Pentagon, or wherever, the White House, or international bodies, and they would adduce the evidence showing what happened. This time, my former colleagues, to their credit, I'm talking about the analysts in the CIA, refused to do it. They refused to support John Kerry's evidence because it wasn't there. It was bogus. It was a red line. It was a provocation. It was a mouse trapping that Kerry was in on. Okay, and so what was produced? Well, a completely new genre. They called it a, quote, government assessment. And they gave that to the press. And, of course, what a government assessment is, it's written by hacks in the White House designed to make a case that the intelligence does not support. So all this just by way of saying that it's been a real mess in the Middle East. The only good news is that now Kerry and Obama, despite great pressure from the Pentagon and other people who would like to see the imbroglio continue in Syria, they've been knocking heads together. They've been saying, "Well, look, you know, let's work together to defeat ISIS, and then we'll work out arrangements with respect to what happens to Bashar al-Assad later." So that's progress from this time last year. But who's continuing to suffer in all this? Of course, the Syrian people. People in Iraq, the people who are going to Western Europe or to Europe in droves to the degree they can. And now, of course, there's sort of an embargo against actual people going where they can get some safety. So if you talk about disarray, if you talk about chaos, well, you've got it in the Middle East. Last thing I'll say is that Obama... Well, maybe I'd say two more things. Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg that during this period, when my friends in intelligence were not willing to support John Kerry's charges that it was Bashar al-Assad that did the sarin attack, during that time, it was imperative that I've lost my train of thought here now. It's imperative that I should remain.
Hold on. Ray, we're coming up to 5 minutes left in the program.
Okay.
And I want to save this question for the end.
Sure.
Let's just say at this moment, unless there's some input that causes her not to win, the machine, the media machine, the money machine, Wall Street, the special interest group, the military industrial complex, they're all behind Hillary Clinton. What is the likely outcome in the Middle East or in that part of the world if Hillary Clinton becomes president? And what is the likely, I realize this is subjective, but likely scenario where Hillary Clinton would support Israel, Israel would then attack Iran, and what would that then portend?
Well, we're talking about a real catastrophe here. Catastrophe. What I would say to this is that Hillary Clinton has said that the first thing she'd do would be to invite Benjamin Netanyahu to visit the White House. That's pretty bad. She has shown herself to be a 110% supporter of whatever Israel wants. And this is all very short-sighted in terms of Israel's real midterm and long-term interests. Because if there's continued strife there, in the long run, there'll be no solution to the Palestinian problem. And Hillary Clinton has shown herself tone-deaf to the rights of the Palestinians. It's going to have a no good end, as the Chinese would say, and there's no daylight between Hillary Clinton and Netanyahu. That spells deep trouble for the interests of our country because George Washington was the one, our first president, who warned against the passionate attachment of one country to the perceived interests of another country. In other words, in those days, of course, he was talking about people who wanted the United States, new country, to join France in the battles in Europe. And he warned against this passionate attachment. And that's what we have now, a passionate attachment to Israel, where now we are hearing that instead of $3 billion, instead of just $3 billion a year, the Israelis are insisting on $5 billion a year out of our treasury, out of the money that we need to support the interests of our own people here, many of whom are living below the poverty level. So I see no good coming out of the Middle East if Hillary Clinton is able to pursue her policies. And one of the things I was going to mention before is that Obama has said that, it was CNN. They say, well, if you had a do-over, if you were given a mulligan, what would you do? Is there something you regret doing? He says, yeah. He says, Libya. No one planned for day two in Libya. Well, I mean, hello? Should we not have learned from not planning for day two in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria? Now, who is the prime mover behind our policy in Libya? It was Hillary Clinton. So how can he, on one hand, say no one is better qualified to be our president now, and then tell CNN, that was his major regret, was attacking Libya with the mayhem that ensued, and nobody planned for day two? Well, Hillary Clinton is not a real good day two player. And if Benjamin Netanyahu is at her shoulder, you can bet your bottom dollar that there's going to be more chaos in the Middle East, that Israel will consider itself protected by us, and that, over the long run, this is not going to be good for Israel as well as not for us, not to
mention
the Palestinians.
Also, when Israel, with no one else's consent or awareness, put that doomsday virus into the Iranian computer system for the whole country, and once it was detected, now Iran had a major program over the last years of getting every young qualified person, older person, to come up with a system that they could do the same as did Russia and China. So you've got a whole lot of people who now understand how to bring down a country. You cut, get rid of its electrical grid, and then you throw it into chaos. So I see this as happening if Hillary's elected, because Netanyahu and Hillary Clinton, I believe that they are capable of making any decision based upon their passions, their hatreds, and not reason. And I hope I am wrong. Ray McGovern, thank you for being on today, and we look forward to our next conversation.
You're most welcome, Gary.
Ray McGovern from Northern Virginia. You can read Ray's articles, and he writes a lot of them on consortiumnews.com or go to Ray McGovern.
We got it together, didn't we? We've definitely got our thing together, don't we? Isn't that nice? I mean, really, when you really sit and think about it, isn't it really, really nice? I can easily feel myself slipping more and more waves. That super world of my own.